Barbara Himes was born and raised near Los Angeles, California. She completed her PhD in German studies at Stanford University. Since that time, she's been moving steadily eastward, and she landed in 1985 on the doorstep of Denise Levertov in Somerville, Massachusetts. She was assistant professor of German at the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma, Boston University, Brandeis, and for one semester at MIT. She has been employed as a technical writer, translator at Siemens Medical Engineering in Danvers, Mass., and a study abroad director for the American Institute for Foreign Studies Partners Program with Humboldt University in Berlin in the early 90s, just a year after German reunification. Through a combination of study research grants and employment opportunities, she lived in Germany for well over 5 years, between 71 and 94. And since 99, she has toiled in the workers' compensation marketing department of Travelers Insurance, its Boston field office, which has enabled her to buy a home in beautiful Gloucester, where she has resided since October 2004. Her current housemate is a 9-pound chocolate brown wiener dog named Bee Bapalula. She must be your baby. Bee Bapalula. She don't mean maybe. Barbara has been writing prose since third grade, making seven contributions to a classroom compilation called Storyland in Room 26, and subsequently published short stories in her high school literary magazine. As a professor, she published numerous articles in scholarly journals on German and Austrian artists and intellectuals in the 18th and 19th centuries. She is no longer a German by profession and now devotes her writing time to 21st century philosophical novel about American consumerism. So, we love the fact that Barbara did this and that she's at the Writers' Center, and she's going to tell us about Levertov and Rilke. Barbara.
Thank you so much for coming, especially in this weather that we seem to have so often in New England. I just want to explain briefly the handouts. The multi-page one is a summary of my entire essay, which appeared in the New England Review. And I realized very quickly that it would be impossible for me to present the entire article by reading it. So I summarized parts of it. So I'm going to give you the introduction, and then I'm going to skip to sections 6 and 7. I encourage you, since most of us are not speed readers, to read the other parts of it later and reflect on how they all fit together. Reading Rilke with Denise Levertov. Like this, they say, my life, my wife, my dog, my child, and know full well that all that, life, and wife, and dog, and child, are foreign forms with which they blindly, and with their hands outstretched, sometimes collide. Certain of this, of course, are only great ones, the ones who long for eyes. So sagen sie, mein Leben, meine Frau, mein Hund, mein Kind, und wissen doch genau, dass alles, Leben, Frau und Hund und Kind, fremde Gebilde sind, daran sie blind mit ihren ausgestreckten Händen stoßen. Gewissheit freilich ist das nur den Großen, die sich nach Augen sehnen. We met at Stanford University in the winter of 1982. I was 30 and had just completed a doctorate in German studies. She was 58. A close friend of mine, Tree Swenson, a founder with Sam Hamill of Copper Canyon Press, told me that Denise Levertov was living on campus. I took a deep breath and phoned her, introducing myself as a friend of friends and a fan of her poetry. Just getting the opportunity to meet her would have seemed to me a gift, so I was stunned when she not only invited me to her apartment for coffee, but readily expressed the hope that I might have time to be an occasional tutor who would read Rilke poems with her in German. She left the choice of poems up to me, and I quickly suggested The Book of Hours, which was composed between 1899 and 1903 and published originally, obviously, in German in 1905. Partly, maybe, because I liked the persona of the perceptive Russian monk attempting to speak to God, and partly because I was avoiding the linguistic complexity of the Duino elegies and the sonnets to Orpheus. Now I'm going to skip to section 6. My Denise Levertov. Levertov and I didn't actually get down to business the year we met. She was only in California for the winter quarter, and in the summer I left for an assistant professorship in Oklahoma, where I taught for 3 years. When we started our reading of Rilke together, she ordered a copy of the same Insel paperback edition of The Book of Hours that I had, so we could refer to the same pagination, and we worked through a couple of poems. Over the next 2 or 3 years, we exchanged occasional letters, and she asked me to send her a few annotated poems from The Book of Hours. When Levertov heard that I had accepted a teaching position at Boston University that was to begin in the fall of 1985, she immediately invited me to house sit for her in Somerville. During the fall and winter, while she traveled and then taught at Stanford during winter quarter, I paid a modest amount of rent to preside over her two-story Victorian house in her absence, and then continued to live with her until late spring of the following year, when I rented an apartment just 3 blocks away on the other side of Davis Square. Our friendship deepened while we lived together daily in this house she had bought a decade earlier. Actually, she bought the house with her husband, Mitchell Goodman, but they were already beginning to decide to get divorced. So it was really only her house. It was tall and narrow, an odd color combination of tan shingles and bright red wood trim, with steep front steps and a chain-link gate that opened to a side shade garden and cement walkway leading to the back door. Despite the minuscule amount of soil included in her property, the garden had been carefully designed and was well tended. Somerville is known for the dense proximity of its houses and compact yards, and Denise's house was surrounded on 3 sides by fences that marked off the bordering properties. Shortly before I moved there, she had spearheaded a neighborhood campaign to prevent a retail owner from tearing down his one-story structure directly behind her house and putting up a high-rise building, which would have prevented the already scant bit of sunlight from reaching her garden. A political rally poster was pinned on the house's front door, which opened into a small entry hall with a coat closet. The furniture in the house wasn't lavish, but it was very comfortable. Large double-paned storm windows on all sides and on every story, including, of course, the finished attic, presented quite a challenge to me when the news media hyped the impending Gloria Hurricane of the Century just weeks after Denise had left the place in my care. I bought rolls of black tape with which to slap X's across every window, then hunkered down in a hallway with a portable radio, a bag of chocolate chip cookies, and a novella by Goethe, waiting for an extreme weather disaster that never materialized. Denise wrote a poem about her house called What My House Would Be Like If It Were a Person, and published it in Life in the Forest in 1978. I am condensing it here to its first line and its final stanza. This person would be an animal. Its intelligence would be of a higher order, neither human nor animal, elvish, and it would purr, though of course, it being a house, you would sit in its lap, not it in yours. Before I actually met her, Denise Levertov had been a powerful consciousness delivered to me through words on paper. Her poems registered in my awareness like allies whispering about experiences we had lived through separately, but in similar terms. Or they spoke of experiences outside the contours of my life, but about which I needed and wanted to know. She had seemed to me a general guide, not a particular person. All that changed when she became a person to me. A single woman in her 60s with an English accent, a gap between her front teeth, and a cackling laugh, she was slow to put on her coat and find her house keys, mischievous and unmistakably sincere. I had never been friends with a famous person before. She received so much daily correspondence that she employed a part-time secretary. She traveled so frequently that she needed a travel agent and a monthly house cleaner. She also had a publisher, a financial advisor, an executor for her literary estate, an agent to schedule poetry readings, and at the end of the 1980s, a real estate broker and lawyer to handle the sale of her Somerville house and the purchase of her new one in Seattle. She received private VIP admission to major exhibitions at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. Famous writers and Nobel laureates came to her house for dinner or dropped by casually for a visit. My fondest memories of this time are of local trips on the Red Line to Harvard Square and all the stops in between to Boston's Park Street and beyond. With her permission, one of her shorter poems had been etched into the floor of the recently constructed Davis Square T station, and we laughed at the honor of standing quite literally on lines that she had written. Denise had never learned to drive, and when I was driving with her in my car, her instructions to me at major intersections were typically, just wiggle a little bit to the left. Oh, just wiggle a little bit to the right. Driving was so anathema to her character that when she declared, "I shall never learn how to drive a computer," the comprehensive finality of her resistance was beyond question. Denise faithfully practiced Rilke's advice to immerse herself in solitude as a necessary foundation upon which to create art. She made time every day to write poetry or prose and to answer correspondence in longhand. Her secretary at the time, Yarrow Cleves, came in several times per week to type finished drafts of poems and business letters. Denise was undoubtedly much more outgoing than Rilke had ever been, and would reward herself amply after writing by socializing with friends and colleagues. She seemed European to me in the way that she prepared leisurely weekend breakfasts for the two of us and sumptuous dinners for a small party of compatible guests at her egalitarian round kitchen table. She was an excellent cook, although I can recall her scorching more than one pot of food by leaving it on the stove while she wandered upstairs or stepped away to answer the phone. She disliked telephone interruptions, but she refused to buy an answering machine because then, she felt, she would be obliged to spend even more time returning people's calls. She loved Robert J. Lertzema's program, Morning Pro Musica, on public radio, which began every day at 7 a.m. with a recording of many chirping birds that gradually gave way to an orchestral piece of Baroque music. Cocking her head like a puppy, she would listen intently. And despite the often serious content of news bulletins, Lertzema's slow, sonorous, lackadaisical manner of reading them between musical selections always amused her. Denise never turned on a television show in a casual way. When we were watching an episode of Masterpiece Theatre on PBS, she especially loved British dramas set during the Second World War. We rarely spoke, and if the phone rang, she didn't answer it. We might as well have been sitting in a movie theater. The program was an artistic object that deserved our full attention, not background noise or a way of killing time. In some ways, one could rightly accuse her of being a Luddite, old-fashioned, suspicious of technological advances in communication. But the advantage to her attitude was a persistent directness, a deep concentration that made conversations with her intensely alive, because she was truly listening to you. In her single-mindedness, she might be seen as someone utterly engaged in a campaign against multitasking. If she needed to turn her attention from one activity to another, she said so, got up, and did it. It makes me laugh to imagine Denise attempting to teach a class of students nowadays who would have their eyes glued to their Android devices, thumbs busily texting away. No doubt she would invite many of them to leave and not return, unless they were willing to be fully present in mind as well as body. From reading the poetry Denise wrote in the 1970s and early 1980s, I know that she had had love affairs during the decade after her divorce. But if she had any romantic liaisons during the second half of the 1980s, I knew nothing of them. She met with friends and acquaintances all over the world, but to me, she spoke more of past relationships than of present ones. Her bed had a large cross affixed to the headboard, and the room had an air of celibacy about it. Her commitment to her work as a poet was evident, but although she embodied the feminist ideal of self-determination, she refused, as she saw it, to be pigeonholed as a woman writer. Her essay, Gender and Genre Versus Serving and Art, makes this abundantly clear. As a literature professor, I was self-conscious about one poem of hers in particular, Artist to Intellectual, Poet to Explainer. She was the former, I the latter. The artist lives, the intellectual measures. The poet creates, consumes, creates unceasing, while the explainer's energy has direction and attempts to tame chaos. I wished fervently that I had the talent to live her life, not mine, which was, of course, impossible. Yet my life had somehow made it possible for us to become friends, close enough for her to agree to serve as best woman at my wedding in 1988. Rilking with Denise. Although both of us were professors, we had grown up in different ways, with very different expectations. Denise's education had not been patterned on the prevailing German, American, or British model, and her essay, The Untaught Teacher, makes clear the challenges she faced as a college professor of writing who had never sat in a classroom. She had been homeschooled in England until the age of 13 by highly literate, multilingual parents. Her mother had read entire 19th century novels aloud to her and her sister. Denise read prolifically and wrote poetry from an early age, and in the course of her lifetime, had opportunities to live in several European countries and Mexico during her marriage to the American writer Mitchell Goodman, and to spend time traveling to many countries all over the world, including war-torn Vietnam in 1972. Her French was accomplished enough for her to translate a volume of Jean Joubert's poetry into English, Black Iris, which was published in 1988 by Copper Canyon Press. But, as she acknowledges at the outset of her Rilke as Mentor essay, her knowledge of German was quite limited. As she put it to me, she had grown up understanding just a bit of kitchen German. Her ultimate goal in reading Rilke with me, a project which she quickly dubbed with the verb to rilk and the gerund rilking, was to have a dialogue with Rilke by writing poems in response to some of his. While I was living with her in the spring of 1986, She gave me a typed draft of her poem based on the first poem in book one of the Book of Hours and wrote next to it in longhand. You may not approve, but I feel that what I can and would like to attempt is a series of variations along these lines. They demand the experiencing of the original you can give me access to. I feel that renouncing all claim to call them translations would give me the freedom to do what I am capable of, instead of my being constrained to attempt what others are better equipped for. Her variations on a theme were eventually published in two consecutive volumes, Breathing the Water in 1987 and A Door in the Hive in 1989. We always began with me reading the German verses aloud, often twice. She listened to me as intently as to her favorite selections of classical music. In celebration of my move to Boston, I had purchased the Rolls-Royce of translation dictionaries, two cumbersome volumes of just the German to English portion of the Langenscheidt New Murray Sanders Encyclopedic Dictionary. That was volume A through K and volume L through Z, each volume being at least 2 inches thick. I would lug them to the living room sofa and keep them at the ready like Jack's magic beanstalk. There were indeed some moments of magic when she asked for the definitions and connotations of a word I wasn't sure about, which I would read aloud to her from the dictionary. This would allow her to begin exploring a whole network of associations. The breadth of her vocabulary was inspiring. For example, I recall her extemporizing brilliantly about the similarities between some German word and its Old English counterpart. For her, writing and thinking were all about language. When I made a trip back to Stanford in late June 1986, Denise wrote to me that she was having a productive summer of writing and asked for some help with one of the poems from the Book of Hours. She wrote, "I believe, with minimal recourse to the dictionary, I can understand all of number 7. Wenn es nur einmal so ganz stille wäre, except for the penultimate line where, damn it, it's the silly little and an that hang me up. Can you send me a literal of this line, dich an alles Leben zu verschenken?" Here is the second of the two stanzas in poem 7. Grab your second handout, the big colorful one. Dann könnte ich in einem tausendfachen Gedanken bis an deinen Rand dich denken und dich besitzen, nur ein Lächeln lang, dich an alles Leben zu verschenken, wie einen Dank. Learning the rules of grammar is the bane of every foreign language student's existence. But without that knowledge firmly in place, silly little words like and an defy comprehension. They are both prepositions that usually translate into English as around or at and to, respectively, but partnered with zu plus the infinitive verb verschenken, so that the construction is zu verschenken. Means in order to give as a gift. And an alles Leben is a prepositional phrase meaning to all living things. Now we have, in order to give as a gift to all living things. But what's the direct object? What is being given? Dich is a form of you, but unlike as in English, you, in which exactly the same word can be the subject of the line, you give, or the direct object, I give you to them, or the indirect object, I give them to you, in German, dich can only be the direct object, you. In Rilke's formulation, the monk, the narrative voice, the I, is giving God as a gift to all living things, wie einen Dank, as thanks, in gratitude. The fact that Dank is a singular noun in German, but plural in English, thanks, makes the grammatical agreement between dich and the declination of einen Dank, masculine direct object, more difficult for an English speaker to recognize. But in the German text, giving you, God, to all living things becomes a simile for expressing my gratitude. No native speaker of German has to cogitate on the grammar in this way, of course, because the parallel is intuitively clear to her. The parallel that English does share with German, however, is the closeness in sound and spelling between denken, danken, and think, thank. And that is at least some solace for a translator. But the entire stanza here is in the subjunctive voice, which means that it is expressing a wish, an unreal condition, or a hypothetical situation. Then I would be able to fathom you in a thousandfold thought, able to comprehend your outermost boundaries and thereby possess you for the length of a smile. And this unrealized anticipation is followed by the two lines I have just parsed. Hence, the monk would like to possess insight into the scope of God's existence just long enough to be able to share his insight with all living things. How long would this precious insight last? Rilke plays with a very common temporal expression for a lifetime, ein Leben lang, strategically substituting an utterly uncommon alliterative noun, lächeln, smile, for Leben, life, for the duration of a smile. Denise ended that letter to me in German. Vielen, vielen Dank, deine Schülerin, Denise. Many, many thanks, your pupil, Denise. In other correspondence, she always closed with love, Denise. The work of Rilking became, for the two of us, an expression of mutual love. My efforts at language instruction have never been appreciated at any other time in my life with such gratitude and such joy. But the work we were doing had another dimension. In the preface to her translations from the Book of Hours, Babette Deutsch suggests that these lyrics allow of interpretations acceptable both to the religious and to the philosophical mind. The religious possibility was almost palpable to Denise, coming as she did from a background that centered on a Russian Jewish father who had converted to Christianity and embraced a new identity as an Anglican minister. And she was at that time exploring her own affinity with Catholic rites of worship. In contrast, I, a Jewish agnostic who had written a doctoral dissertation called Responses to Secularization in Robert Musil's The Man Without Qualities, took a decidedly philosophical, if not sociological, view of Rilke as one of Musil's contemporaries in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This evident divergence between our readings of Rilke might have produced some interesting and far-reaching conversations, but we both avoided some topics, sensing that intellectual and spiritual differences could potentially destroy our friendship. We didn't talk about narrative voice, or modernist art as a substitute religion, or the biographical context of Rilke's enthusiasm for Russia as his spiritual home. In hindsight, I know that we left too much unsaid. For example, we went to see the new Wim Wenders Peter Handke film, Wings of Desire, which came out in Germany in 1987, as soon as it premiered in Boston. And it should have been a joyous Rilke fest for the two of us, since the Rilkean conceit of angels in homage to the Duino elegies is one of the aesthetic underpinnings of the film. As we drove back to Somerville, Denise exclaimed, "Wasn't that just pure poetry?" "I guess so," I replied, "if you believe in the existence of angels." I was having fun playing the devil's advocate, but because we had never talked at all about Rilke's angel imagery, the joke fell flat, and Denise was silent the rest of the way home. Babette Deutsch describes Rilke's monk as an adherent of the peculiar faith that Rilke ascribed to his spiritual kinsman, a faith in a god remote from the august, if benign, father of Western Christianity. Here Russia is being seen already as the East. A god, rather, who was waiting to be born of the artist's alert and sensitive consciousness. And she goes on to suggest a possible affinity between Rilke and the English Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins, the most devout of religious poets. A different critic, Johannes Wich Schwarz, you can guess that he's German, on the other hand, provides compelling alternative examples of the ways in which Rilke draws on Christ imagery to express a post-Christian worldview. While Rilke never accepted organized religion, Wich Schwarz contends that in contrast to many other modernist writers, Rilke was still deeply involved in Christian heritage, although he himself had discarded belief in it. Both Rilke and Levertov had been well-schooled by their families in Christian tradition, but they struggled in rather different ways with issues of doubt and faith. Significantly, in the mid-1980s, Denise underwent a major shift from an agnostic stance to an embrace of the mystery of Christ's incarnation and the solace of Christian faith. Her friend Murray Bodo knew her during the last 20 years of her life and deftly observes the interplay between Denise's poetic and spiritual development. In fact, Denise had made it clear that she was quite intrigued by Hopkins' transformation of contemplative experience into poetic form back in 1965 in a mid-career essay on organic poetry called Some Notes on Poetic Form. In this essay, she adopts Hopkins' terms inscape, which means the intrinsic form of single objects and their relation to one another, and instress, the poet's exploratory method of recognizing how he perceives those forms. Denise asserts in that essay that the condition of being a poet results when a constellation of experiences wakes in him this demand, the poem. She goes on to describe the poet's period of contemplation, which stems from the Latin word templum, a space for observation in the presence of a god. Contemplation leads to the crystallization of vision, the forming of words which may ultimately result in a finished poem. Bodo's essay shows how Denise's explanation of her art used historically sacred language to document a process which for her, as a long-standing agnostic, had not been inherently religious. Bodo sees the decisive turning point in her essay, A Poet's View, which was first published in Religion and Intellectual Life in 1984, in which Denise identified imagination as the chief of human faculties and the means by which she would ultimately succeed or fail in actually experiencing God. As a biographer of Denise's, Dana Green, observes, Denise was increasingly attracted to the mystical tradition of the Catholic Church and influenced by her friendship with contemplatives like Murray Bodo. Green writes, in about 1988, she became a Catholic, admitting that she did not like the hierarchical structure of the church, nor its inflexible dogma, but that, like others, she would now criticize from within. She published a volume of selected previously published poems on religious themes, The Stream and the Sapphire, in 1997, the year she died. She wrote in her foreword, "This enterprise, in what I think of as do-it-yourself theology, seemed at the time of writing to risk presumption. But I later discovered it was much like what Ignatius of Loyola recommended in the Exercises." In all the years of our friendship, Denise and I had only one major dispute. While I was directing a Berlin study abroad program in newly reunified Germany, she visited for a week in January 1992 before continuing on to Rome. On the last night of her stay, we had dinner together in an Italian restaurant. Toward the end of the meal, the conversation had wandered into the history of Christianity. Denise talked about the many good works Christians had performed, and suddenly I burst out with counterexamples ranging from the Crusades to the Pope's complicity with Hitler in persecuting the Jews of Europe. After a momentary expression of surprise, Denise met me head on with distinctions between church bureaucracy and kind-hearted, even heroic individuals. She and I chewed at our bone of contention like two dogs and were probably the last customers to leave the restaurant. As bad as things seemed between us that night, she and I were friends again the next day, and her subsequent postcard from Italy thanked my husband Mark and me sincerely for our hospitality. The last time I saw her was at the Modern Language Association conference in San Diego in 1994. She had arranged to meet me and was going to be giving a poetry reading at a session in her honor, Denise Levertov, Christian Perspectives, sponsored by the Conference on Christianity and Literature. "I know Christianity isn't your thing," Denise said with a wry smile. "It doesn't matter," I said. "I'm coming to hear you." Denise's last letter to me and my husband is dated December 30th, 1996, 1 year almost to the day before she died. She told us that she had had a difficult year and apologized for not replying sooner to a letter I had written to her the previous spring. She was being treated with chemotherapy for lymphoma, but assured us she was on the mend. Her ex-husband, Mitch, was dying, and their son, Nick, had flown to Maine to be with him during his final days. She was trying to conserve her energy to stay in touch only with close friends, the two of us among them. She wanted news from us, wanted to know what books we were reading, what films we were seeing. "How I miss our Rilking," she wrote. The following summer, in the last months of her life, she mailed us an elegant Copper Canyon Press broadside of a poem called River. It is a sparsely phrased meditation on the way in which a river flows toward and ultimately mingles with the open sea. It is now January 2015, 33 years since I first met Denise. In the 18 years since her death, much has been written about this imposing figure of 20th century American poetry. Although her annotated correspondence with William Carlos Williams was well underway and appeared the year after she died, I didn't read it until 2011. Williams wrote to her on February 11th, 1957. "Even recently, I fight against accepting you unconditionally. It must always be so with a person we love and admire. It must be in the words themselves and what you find to do with them, and what you have the spirit and trust to rely on the reader to find what you have put among them. Where is it? In detail, microscopically." Williams, no less than Rilke, was her mentor, and his comment resonates with me. The details of her being retain their power. She was immensely lovable, yet demanding, both as a poet and a person. The intensity of her self-knowledge, her acute observations of human nature, as well as the natural world, and the courage to speak her mind always are foremost in my memories of her. The sense of peculiar loneliness associated with creative genius may now seem to us like a cliché, but Denise expresses it with fresh poignancy in a poem called Poet and Person. "But soon you love me less. I brought with me too much. Too many laden coffers, the panoply of residents improper to a visit. Silks and furs, my enormous wings, my crutches and my spare crutches, my desire to please and worse, my desire to judge what is right. Thank you. So, in my mind, I've left 25 minutes for discussion and drinking.
Barbara, whose translation? Is this your translation?
Yeah, but it's what you would call a trot. It's a literal. It's very, very literal, because I wanted to use it to demonstrate the grammar I was talking about. It's not anybody's translation.
Did she write anything as a specific response to this particular poem?
She did, actually, yeah. It's in, I think it's in Breathing the Water. Yeah. And there's an I've given you a lot of bibliographical references, and one that I really admire is written by a friend of hers who I met. His name is Edward Zlotkovsky, and he's done a pretty close study comparing her her specific themes or variations on a theme by Rilke. And he points out very rightly, among many other things, that it can't be a one-for-one comparison, because Rilke wrote his poems in his 20s, and Denise wrote her poems in the fullness of her maturity in her 60s, and Rilke was writing in a presumed voice, whereas Denise was not. So it's a very interesting comparison, in which Denise is grappling, I think, much more honestly with her own sense of belief and doubt than Rilke. Rilke was wearing a mask. Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about the tension between the philosophical perspective and the mystical perspective, and I'm really looking forward to reading your article about how Rilke was understood differently in Germany and in the U.S. But I'm wondering if you know whether Rilke himself saw a contradiction in those two different interpretations of his writing.
Rilke was very much a modernist, in that he felt that he was one of the special elect of the human species, and he had a very special particular role in society as a poet, as an artist, and he wasn't really big on reading philosophy. He had read some, and he was acquainted earlier than most people were with some of the writings of Nietzsche, because one of his early mentors was Lou Andreas Salome, a woman who was at least 15 years older than he was and who had known Nietzsche probably the 1860s. Nietzsche was institutionalized the last decade of the 19th century, and Rilke was born in 1875, so there was no chance that Rilke could meet Nietzsche. But through Lou, he knew some things about Nietzsche, and he shared this Nietzschean sense that the peasantry of Russia is more pure, is more like the medieval feudal person of belief. And Rilke had a strong tendency to think that people who lived in feudal, poor conditions were in their proper place in life, that it was horrible that this modern era was trying to make everybody the same. And it was, if Rilke had had his way, he would have gone back to the Middle Ages. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but Rilke saw himself as an elite artist, and it was very important to him to meet other elite artists. He made sure that Lou Andreas Salome introduced him to Tolstoy. That was very important when they went to Russia, and he wanted to be known in certain circles as a writer to be reckoned with. But for him, it was much more about being an artist, and that's why he was so interested in other, like the plastic sculpture artists of Rodin and then the paintings of Cezanne. That was what was really essential to him.
Describing really as a romanticist, not a modernist.
Well, the modernists had a tendency to choose the previous eras that they thought were best in the course of history. Nietzsche, of course, thought that the ancient Greeks and the early Romans were it. They were the best. And so I'm talking about something that is inherent to a lot of modernists, but it's a way of looking at the past and evaluating it and placing some eras of the past as superior to other eras. There's a wonderful book which I really recommend, and I didn't put on this sheet, but it's five portraits of German writers by a Berkeley comparative lit professor named Bernstein, very good name, and I think it's Michael Andre Bernstein, and it's five portraits of modernist thinkers. And what they all have strongly in common is this sense of being special. Modernism is very, very evaluative. There's the really great ones and the herd. The ones who don't count.
This is unrelated to Levertov, but
yeah.
In your German studies, was there a particular period or authors that you particularly were interested in?
It's not related to Levertov. Or it is.
No, not really. But
well, I was really intrigued by Robert Musil. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of you have read anything by him. The Man Without Qualities has been translated a couple of times now. And I loved that novel. It's a send-up of the old Austro-Hungarian Empire in the days just prior to the outbreak of World War I, and this group of society people are planning a special jubilee, a special celebration for the Kaiser. What is Kaiser? It's not king.
Emperor.
For the emperor, yes, for Emperor Franz Josef. And of course, as we know historically, World War I destroyed, broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But these people are all busy planning this great activity. And it's a send-up not just of society per se, but of many, many different streams of intellectual thought, with characters being sort of slightly changed parodies of actual intellectuals. That was one of my favorites. In German studies, I mostly taught courses that were either 19th or 20th century literature, and German cinema was becoming more and more interesting to the American public and was also a very effective way of getting students more involved. And actually including students who didn't know German but who would read the subtitles and who were excited about film and who wanted to learn something about this particular strand of film. Of course, I read Kafka and a lot of... I guess I would say that the prose writers of the 20th century were my favorites. And another great favorite of mine is Günter Grass. Have any of you perchance read Dog Years? That is the most hilarious, wonderful, magical realism book in which he makes tremendous fun of Heidegger, among others. But the story is told from the perspective of a dog. And of course, the dog is not just any dog, but a German shepherd of superior breeding.
Robert, so did you teach... So you used film in your teaching?
Like, well, I taught specific courses that were called the New German Cinema, mm-hmm. or we didn't call the other films the Old German Cinema, but that would be the classic era of the 1920s. Yeah.
Did the fact that Rilke's work was the Nazi Party tended to like and use his work, did that change your opinion of him and his work at all?
Well, I don't base my opinions on what monsters do with texts, what they do. Strangely, what they did in the case of Rilke was they basically decided, I'm talking about Nazi propaganda officials, they decided that he was pretty harmless. And it was just extraordinary that this one particular book flag bearer, cornet Christoph Rilke, who was supposedly a aristocratic forebearer of Rilke himself, charged into the burning castle to save the flag, and he didn't have time to save the woman, but he got the flag and he died, and everybody, all the women at home cried about him. And the point is that not just soldiers of World War I took this little paperback edition with them into battle, but also in World War II, they took that same Rilke prose poem into battle. So the Nazis were fine with that. And they were also fine with this really delicate sense of inwardness, which some people cultivated as they read this poetry. Because if German citizens were going to obey all of the rules that the Nazis imposed, but had this interior sense that they were free and they were in an elevated state, well, that was fine. As long as they did everything they were supposed to, and they didn't, if they held this freedom inside and didn't, you know, talk at meetings about, hey, what do you think of this, you know, if it was so interior, then it was harmless. And that's why they allowed Rilke to be published consistently throughout their 12-year reign. What I find so interesting about Germany, and especially a place like Berlin, is that you see, well, it's even more obvious with architecture, but you see these different periods of history in the buildings. And to the extent that they weren't bombed out and completely eradicated, they stand next to each other. And it's the history of Germany. So when you look at the reception of a writer throughout the 20th century in Germany, which went through so many upheavals in the 20th century, you are seeing what the fashion or the taste of the day was. And of course, you have to distinguish between the scholarly taste of the day and the popular who goes out to a bookstore and buys a book of poetry because they like poetry. It's not necessarily the same group of people. But the German, a lot of West Germans themselves were embarrassed after World War II by the very thought of carrying a Rilke book in their back pocket as they went to war. So they didn't want to think about that kind of affection they had earlier had for this poet. But that doesn't make me think less of Rilke. What it makes me think of is how we can't separate a text from who we are when we read it. We as Americans may be reading, are in most cases, reading Rilke in a different way because we have a different history with Rilke. Rilke translations didn't really get going and really get going until the 1970s. And that was peace and love and get out of Vietnam. And what I didn't pass out to all of you, but what is available, if you'd like it, is I have a thing for bibliographies, as Henry and Annie know very well. And this is all the translations that have been done. There are like 25 translations of selected poems of Rilke, and they just keep coming. So if you're just going to recycle it, don't take one, but you are welcome to take this bibliography. And I excluded all of the correspondence and the musical compositions that have been written because it was just too much. But I think there are at least 20 different interpretations of the Duino elegies and the sonnets to Orpheus. So anybody who wants this, you're welcome to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.